Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Congressman Pat Tiberi was first elected to Ohio's 12th congressional district. That's from Delaware County and portions of Franklin and Licking counties in November 2000. He serves on the House Ways and Means Committee as chairman of the Subcommittee on Select Revenue, and that has jurisdiction over federal tax policy. In addition, he is a member of the Social Security Subcommittee. He's joined us today for about 20 minutes. So if you have a question or comment for him, give him a call, 614-292-8513. Welcome to the show, Congressman Tiberi.
Great to be with you, Ann.
So, you know, I've known you for about 20-odd years, maybe a little less. I know it makes me cringe, too. But, you know, I never would have exactly thought of you necessarily, since particularly because you were one of the most outspoken that I knew of people that opposed earmarks and that sort of thing in Congress. But I want to ask you how it feels to be a moderate conservative now. I mean, the world has turned, and relatively speaking, you're not part of the conservative, what a lot of people would think of as the conservative branch of the Republican Party in Congress.
Times have changed a lot, and over the course of my lifetime, think about it, since I've been an adult, when I grew up in Columbus.
Since you've been in the legislature.
Well, even since I've been in the legislature. But think about this. No, I want to go back farther because as a student enrolled at Ohio State growing up in Columbus, I grew up in a Democrat family, a conservative Democrat family. And I remember my dad, the first Republican my dad voted for was Ronald Reagan in 1980. And
which
I was
is
in
very
high school,
common.
Mm-hmm. Which was common. But I went to school at Ohio State, and I had a political science instructor who you know by the name of Herb Asher.
Yes.
And I'm probably the only student that Herb ever had that went into the class as a Democrat and came out as a Republican. It has changed in the 80s. It changed again in the 90s, and it certainly changed over the last 10 years, where we have, we have conservatives from some parts of this country that are more conservative than anybody I've met in Ohio. And then you have Democrats from Ohio that are much more liberal than Democrats from the South, and Democrats from the South that are more conservative than some of our Republicans. So it is really very different in Washington than it is in Columbus at the State House.
Do you consider yourself a Tea Party
No, I don't consider myself really anything other than a legislator. I don't like labels. I certainly think
besides that, Republican.
Well, you have to be something. So I am a Republican. I always thought I was conservative, like, as you pointed out. But I think I'm not part of the Tea Party caucus. But I think the Tea Party has done something that is good, and that is people are engaged. Whether it's on the left, the right, the center, getting people engaged in government, I think, is a good thing. Getting people engaged in getting information, whether it's from your show, whether it's from the Dispatch, is so important. One of the things that I think has harmed the atmosphere in Washington, I haven't paid as much attention to the State House, is that both sides, whether you're on the left or the right, get information from non-news sources and they consider them news. Whether it be a talk radio program, whether it be the internet, whether it be a talk show on Fox or MSNBC, and suddenly somebody says something and it's a fact, rather than the traditional news that I went to journalism school, you were a journalist at the Dispatch and the Blade. I think that is so lacking in today's environment. So the good news is information is plentiful. The bad news is you don't have reporters that are there sifting the information as the number one source. It's a lot of information, but not all of it's good. And people tend to go to what they want to hear.
The supercommittee's been assigned to deal with the debt come up with a solution in the next couple months. What is your advice from where you sit? You've been in Congress for a long time. Some people are being appointed to that have been appointed to the committee who do not have even a fraction of your experience at the federal level.
Well, most of the 12 do. In fact, my chairman of my committee, Dave Camp, is a member of that committee, and we have had dozens of hearings since January on tax reform. On Social Security and the problem with the Social Security Trust Fund. And those are the entitlement issues, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, that are part of whatever solution we come to, whether it's this year, whether it's next year, it has to come soon. And tax reform has to be part of this as well. And whether the committee works, the select committee works or not, we are going to continue to work on our committee to try to come up with a solution. And there are really good people on both sides of the aisle on that committee. But it's going to be hard in the next 4 or 5 months to come up with something significant, whether it's tax reform or whether it's entitlement reform. It's going to be very difficult.
I know that you think, you told the Licking County Tea Party recently, I think we have a debt crisis in America because Washington spends too much, not taxes too little.
Mm-hmm.
Last week we talked about the cost of war. And the fact that this is the first time ever that this is the longest war so far in the war against terror, if you want to, wrap it all up into one label, that we have not had to sacrifice anything for. There's no excise. There's been no surtax on war this time around. It costs us trillions of dollars, $2 million a day in Libya alone right now.
Right.
As far as our contribution to the NATO effort there, what about that?
Well, if you look over the course of the last 10 years, the last year that Rob Portman, who's now our U.S. senator, who's on this committee, by the way, was budget director, which was 2006 for the fiscal year 2007, our budget deficit, so that's our yearly in the red total, was $165 million. Compared to this year, which is going to be $1.6 trillion. At the time, we were in the middle of two wars. We had a Medicare prescription drug benefit. We had the tax cuts. We were in the middle of those tax cuts that people say cost money. And yet we were down to $165 billion before Nancy Pelosi took control of Congress. Today, we're estimated to go to $1.6 trillion. We've been over a trillion the last 2 years.
But we've also
well.
Upped our efforts in Afghanistan.
We've drawn them down in Iraq at the same time.
But drawdown isn't necessarily saving us money at this point.
Well, it is saving
us money. It's expensive.
It is expensive. There's no question it's expensive. But we have fewer troops in Iraq today than we did 5 years ago. And by the way, there is bipartisan support for what the president has talked about, and that is a glide path toward an exit in Iraq and an exit in Afghanistan. But to your point earlier, we are in a much different place than we've ever have been with respect to the war on terrorism. When we get out of Iraq and when we get out of Afghanistan, the war against terrorism is not going to be over. This is something that's going to be with you and I for the rest of our lives.
614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you want to speak to our guest right now. Congressman Pat Teaberry, he represents the 12th Congressional District. He's here in the studio with us right now. And John, you're on the air with us from Grandview. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ann. Basically, you've sort of stolen my thunder because my little conversation
you can
was
think
basically
of something
all,
else.
All about taxes.
Well, we could talk for taxes for hours.
Well, I'll be brief and simply say that one of the reasons that Congress's reputation right now is so low in the polls is because people don't think you're solving problems. Now, I'm not pointing at you directly. I'm talking about Congress as a whole.
Sure.
But 15 years ago, there was a poll, and they asked Americans if they thought the tax codes needed to be simplified, and 95% of them surprisingly said, yes, it needs to be simplified.
Sure.
And yet, since that time, more and more loopholes have been put in by congresspeople for
yep.
various public interests and financial interests, and it just gets worse and worse. And it seems to me that one of the ways to help and get new revenue in here would be to revise the tax code. It would seem
Amen.
To me that it's something that reasonable people could agree with.
We agree.
And my only little qualifier in that is, and I don't know that you are or aren't, because I haven't looked you up, but a lot of people have signed on with Grover Norquist that they refuse to raise taxes.
Right.
Now, to me, that takes intellectual thought out of the picture.
Let me address that, though. If you look historically, and I want to talk about the reasonable people as well, because that's a really good point, and I agree with everything you said. But on the revenue side, revenues coming into the federal government versus expenditures going out, and this is why I said to Ann's quote, it's a spending problem. Our spending as a percentage of the economy at the federal level is at an all-time high in our lifetime. The last time it was this high, 25% of the economy, was during World War II. The last 3 years have taken a huge trend upward in terms of our spending.
And yet we've also lowered taxes. The tax rates were much higher during World War II.
Well, the revenue that was coming in from taxes until the Great Recession of 2008 was high. I mean, revenue was coming in, to his point, it was great. It wasn't as great as it was during the 90s when the economy was buzzing. And the best way to get more revenues is getting somebody a job so they're paying more taxes. But the revenue is at an all-time high. So we got to get the revenue back down, the spending is at an all-time high. So we got to get the spending back down. But to the point of on tax reform, the problem that you have is reasonable people disagree on how to get there. We have, on just on the the Republican side in. We had a hearing in the Ways and Means Committee less than a month ago, and we had a hearing on the fair tax. Some Republicans will say the only way to reform the tax code is through a fair tax, which is a national sales tax. Other Republicans say the only way to reform the tax code is through a flat tax. And so during the Bush years, when Republicans controlled the House, had 55 votes in the Senate, the reason why we couldn't do major tax reform is couldn't get Democrats to make the tax code less progressive than it is today, and couldn't get enough Republicans to get off either what they believed was the perfect plan. There wasn't compromise. And at the end of the day, you got to compromise. We don't have a kingdom here. We don't have a dictatorship. We have a republic, a form of government that you have to compromise. And compromise in some quarters is a dirty word. And that was the problem with the debt ceiling, because you have people with very different viewpoints. But at the end of the day, you got to compromise. And we will on the tax code as well.
Thank you, John, for that call. And thanks for waiting to get on the air. Sorry to steal your thunder there. I'm sure I didn't. But talking about people very apart on things, I think that's you're putting it nicely. I mean, if there's what people are shocked and appalled across the country,
sure,
at the acrimony,
yep,
in Congress now, and it doesn't feel like anything's going to get done. And a lot of people are turning a jaundiced eye on this super committee,
sure,
on
debt
reduction.
I don't like the super committee either.
They don't believe that they're really going to achieve anything.
They may not.
And they don't believe that Congress can really achieve anything but these temporary stopgap measures that they've been pulling for the last, 4 to 6 years, really.
Well, Ann, you've been around the media for a while, and the Congress is a reflection of the country. The country is very divided. If you look at letters that I got in my office back in 2001 versus letters I get today, both from the right and the left, both from conservatives and liberals, the acrimony in the letters, the tone of the letters, is much more divided. People say, why don't you criticize the president more? Why don't you call it? That's not my style, but people want to hear that stuff. And then when you look at an MSNBC or a Fox News, they tend to invite people who reflect what people want to hear. And that's a problem in our government and our society today.
Do you feel like your role as a member of Congress is to reflect or lead?
I think it's to lead, and that's why you don't see me out there being personally critical of the president. While I disagree with his policy, and I don't think that he has led in a way that a president should lead, I don't think you need to be personal and angry about a person who is either the president or another elected official just because they have a different viewpoint.
Al in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, my question is, how do you plan to help Medicare? You recently had an advertisement in the Dispatch and sent a large mailer saying that the president wanted to harm Medicare and that,
right,
you want to help it.
I
wonder how you justify that when you voted for the Ryan budget, which actually destroys Medicare.
Doesn't destroy it.
And it makes, unless people pay $6,000 an average per year to maintain the present system.
Okay,
last year, you voted against the seniors' issues 10 out of 10 times.
Okay.
Problem we have with the deficit, the federal debt, 8 out of the 14 trillion came during the Bush time, and I'll count for them. I know exactly how many trillion came from each thing.
We're running out of time, Al. I want to give Congressman T. Berry a chance to respond, and thank you so much for your call.
It was not for me. It was from an independent group, and as Ann knows, you can't do anything about ads from independent groups, whether they're on the left or on the right. And I've had a lot of them on the left come against me that weren't accurate. So the Ryan budget, let me just tell you, it doesn't destroy Medicare. It's patterned after a Bill Clinton, John Breaux commission, a Clinton commission that John Breaux, a Democrat senator from Louisiana in the 1990s, came up with this idea. And it's not a really radical idea in any way. It's really copying the federal employees' health benefit system. And if you're poor, you get more subsidy. In fact, if you're really poor, you get complete subsidy. If you're Warren Buffett, you're probably going to pay the entire bill. Right now, the average senior, and I sit on the subcommittee dealing with Social Security and Medicare, Ian, the average senior puts about one-third of their benefit in with them and their employer into what they get out of Medicare. Mm-hmm. That cannot continue. It's unsustainable. And the trustees, most of whom have been appointed by Obama, have told us that's unsustainable. So you have to change the current system to make it sustainable.
A lot of people on Medicare don't think of themselves as poor. They simply can't afford the cost of health care in the United States anymore, period.
Well, it depends what their assets are.
If you're paying one-third of your income and you've worked all your whole life and you've paid into it and now you're spending a third of what you have coming in just on health care.
No, no, no. What I'm saying is the average senior pays one-third of what they get out of Medicare. It's very different than Social Security. You and I and Americans are subsidizing Medicare.
Right.
In a huge way that's unsustainable.
Medicare pays whatever it has to, whereas Social Security, you only get back what you put into it, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. There's a huge difference between those two programs, and Medicaid's even different yet, which is you're not paying anything into Medicare. It's completely general revenue fund. And because of health care, which is going up a lot, but there's no skin in the game. I just met with a group of doctors the other day, to this gentleman's point, and they are scared to death with the changes in the president's health care bill. They are really, really scared, and most of them don't want their kids to go into medicine. That is not a good thing when doctors don't want their sons and daughters to go into medicine because of the changes they see coming out of this Congress from the last bill that the Congress passed with the president, the Affordable Care Act. That's a problem.
We have to cut it off there. Congressman Pat Teaberry, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it. Will you come back?
Thank you. I will.
All righty. Congressman Pat Teaberry. He represents Ohio's 12th Congressional District. Coming up, we're going to talk about Libya, what's happening there, and how it might affect Syria. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Rebels in Libya declare the era of Gaddafi is over. The fighting continues. 6 months after the Arab Spring began, rebel leaders face a new challenge, rebuilding their country. I'm Rebecca Roberts, the next steps for Libya, plus a proposal to take away your tax deduction for mortgage interest. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. And this is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Join All Sides tomorrow at 11 o'clock for a discussion of binge drinking on college campuses. That discussion is tomorrow at 11, right here on 89.7 FM. And high school football has never had a higher profile, but with a lack of athletic trainers, has the amped-up culture outrun necessary protections for the boys who play the game? Watch Frontline Football High. It's tonight at 10 on WOSU-TV. Sunny skies today and a high of 83 degrees. Right now it is 73 degrees in downtown Columbus. Partly cloudy skies and a low of 61 for tonight. Some sunshine for Wednesday. Also a chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm in the afternoon. And a high of 85. Clouds Wednesday night with a chance of scattered rain showers and a low of 69 degrees. Some sunshine for Thursday and a high of 82. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
As rebel forces continue the battle for Tripoli, Libyan strongman ruler Muammar Gaddafi has disappeared from sight. At least he has since I checked this morning. So what's next? Here's what local businessman Hamdi Salman said, who moved here from Libya to the United States as a teenager. Here's what he's saying.
Because it's going to be completely different this time. You know, you'd be walking the street and you don't have to look over your shoulder or somebody's going to grab you or tolerate you. You know, you'll be, you know, just walking the street, you know, like you know, the king of the streets.
Hamdi Salman plans on returning to Libya for a visit. That's his impression of how it will be when he returns. We'll hear more from Hamdi later on in the show about his hopes for a future free and democratic Libya. First, we welcome Peter Fever. He teaches political science and public policy at Duke University, and he's a director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Professor Fever was the special advisor for strategic planning and institutional reform on the National Security Council staff at the White House from 2005 to 2007, and he is co-author of Paying the Human Costs of War. Welcome, Professor Fever.
Thank you for having me.
We just heard from a local businessman about his hopes for returning to Libya, at least for a visit. What are the chances, do you think, that he'll be able to walk the streets without fear anytime soon?
Well, that's a very hopeful assessment, and I don't think there are many people who would mourn the passing of Gaddafi, except for, of course, his tribe. The problem is that there's a power vacuum in Libya right now. It's evident in the chaos in Tripoli. We're not sure where Gaddafi is. We're not sure who is in custody. The rebels claimed they had one of his sons in custody, and then he shows up at the airport. At the hotel. And so there's a lot of confusion. There's a power vacuum. And in that kind of power vacuum, there can be serious security problems, rioting, looting, and revenge killing. So I think it'll be a while before it would be safe to walk the streets.
How important is it that Gaddafi is still at large?
Psychologically, it's a challenge, but I think President Obama is right when he says Gaddafi's days are numbered. I think it's not likely that Gaddafi's could restore his control over Tripoli, let alone over all of Libya. So I think in terms of his hold on political power, that's lost forever. But if he hides out, that creates uncertainty that the rebel regime, the new political leaders, will have to deal with. Remember when Saddam Hussein went missing for, about 8 months?
Mm-hmm.
That provided a psychological boost to the insurgency, even though Saddam Hussein obviously had little political control during that period. He was on the run, but that was enough to encourage the insurgents.
My guest is Professor Peter Fever from Duke University. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about Libya. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, post your question or comment there. How far might he go to hold on to power, or is it pretty much that power has gone away now and it's just a matter of tracking him down?
Right. I think his capacity to seize political power, even to negotiate a safe landing for him in some cushy villa in a foreign country, those moments are lost. But his capacity to do damage, what might be called the Samson option of bringing the house down on him and on his political foes, I think he still has some of those opportunities. There's a very sizable arsenal of weapons that Libya had, and some of those weapons could go missing, could end up in the hands of terrorists who would strike back at the people that Gaddafi would blame for bringing him down, including NATO, including the United States. So there's ways that he could strike back even in his severely weakened state.
How can the United States and NATO support the rebel takeover, especially given the state of the country's infrastructure in the best of times? That was a problem in Iraq. I imagine it will be in Afghanistan when the time comes that you're dealing with such, colossal rubble. How do you start rebuilding?
Well, the good news for Libya is that they have a commodity that they can produce that the world will buy in a hurry, and that is oil. So there is an economic route to rebuilding Libya. They have they could provide their own their own funds that they need, provided that the oil refineries could be brought back online. So far as we've been able to determine, the damage there isn't as extensive as even as it was in Iraq. So there is some hope there. But where I would say there's a bigger challenge for a bigger economic challenge for the new leaders in Iraq is, in Libya, is mm-hmm. managing all of the humanitarian challenges that the war produced. Libya relied very heavily on expat labor. Most of that expat labor fled or is in refugee camps. There's a lot of land that was confiscated, a lot of sort of things that happen on the margins of war have to be sorted out. And that requires a pretty firm political hand, a security hand, and also a rule of law. And establishing all of that in the chaos of the next couple months, that'll be a real challenge. So it could be months before the Libyan economy comes back online.
What is your impression of the National Transitional Council and its ability to take over given these challenges?
Well, we don't know as much about that as we need to. One of the biggest challenges they'll face is that with the fall of Gaddafi, the principal thing that was binding them together is gone. What bound them together was their opposition to Gaddafi. They are sort of a loose organization, some tribal-based, there's some ideological-based. Some of the group is very congenial to Western interests, secular, with a desire to establish a pluralistic democracy. We could deal with those people, but they're probably not the supermajority. They might not even be a majority or even a plurality in the leadership. And so there's some elements of the that hated Gaddafi, but otherwise don't have much in common with what we'd like to see in Libya. And sorting all of that out is going to be a challenge. Remember, just a month ago, if you had had me on a month ago, we'd be talking about the total chaos inside the rebel ranks.
They had
assassinated a defector from Gaddafi's regime who had joined them rather prominently, and then he was killed in some mysterious way. We still don't quite know how that happened. They were in severe disarray. So within a couple weeks, they have managed to achieve a military tactical success. But I would say politically, there's still a work in progress.
Now, the U.S. says there's no U.S. boots on the ground there. What do you credit this turnaround over the last 2 weeks?
Well, a couple things happened. There was a lot of military advising that was done for the rebels, and so they developed a campaign for Tripoli that was heavily assisted by outside experts in terms of the planning of it. Secondly, the NATO and the United States responded to the critics. For months now, the critics have said that the NATO air campaign was not sufficient. It was too slow. It wasn't pressing the Gaddafi regime hard enough, and in the last several weeks they shifted to a more aggressive posture, and then the rebels in the West, the Western part, which were only loosely coordinated with the main political rebel force in the East, the rebel force in the West achieved some tactical victories, and it culminated, or it appears to have culminated, in the collapse of Gaddafi inside Tripoli. But it's more of a tactical victory right now. I wouldn't call it a strategic victory, not until the political order is sorted out.
How much do you think the sorting out of the political order will depend on, or maybe that's too strong of a word, but be affected by people like Hamdi Salaman returning there to even visit, if not help?
Well, I don't know that particular gentleman, but there is a large expat community abroad.
Right.
As we learned in the Iraq case, though, the expats can be a source of great technical expertise, know-how, and so they can bring international support with them, but they have to be able to graft themselves into local power structures, and there's always a tension between the locals who stayed throughout the hated regime and expats who didn't. And in Iraq, that tension proved to be the undoing of the early efforts to establish an Iraqi face to the new Iraq. So the summer of 2003, or actually late spring of 2003, just that effort foundered, in part because the expats could never completely gain the political support inside Iraq that they needed. I suspect that expats in Libya will have a similar challenge.
My guest once again is Peter Feaver. He's a political science professor at Duke University. We have a few more minutes with him. We're talking about Libya. I want to turn my sights to Syria now. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So in Syria, rebels have been trying to topple the regime there since mid-March. How are they reacting, or how do you expect them to react in Syria to the news that the rebels in Libya have reached Tripoli, have the success that they have so far?
I think they'll be encouraged, although there's important differences between the two movements. The rebels in Libya were doing a lot of shooting. The protesters in Syria are getting a lot of shot at. Mm-hmm. So it's a more of a one-sided fight inside Syria so far. The rebels in Libya received extensive support, not just rhetorical support, but military support from the international community. Right now, the protesters in Syria are just getting rhetorical support, although some economic sanctions are pressuring Assad. Syria, in some ways, is the more important case. Libya poses a severe humanitarian challenge, and there's certainly a terrorism challenge that could emanate from Libya. But Syria is in the heart of the Middle East and is the most important ally of Iran, which poses the most serious strategic challenge to U.S. Interests in the region. So what happens in Syria matters for American national security to a very great extent. And so I would imagine that as world attention shifts from Libya to Syria, the situation there is going to become extremely tense.
One of the conditions in Libya at the outset was that the army really wasn't that powerful there. And that's not necessarily the case in Syria, is it?
Well, Gaddafi went to great lengths to coup-proof himself,
right,
by keeping a very weak and divided military with key sort of units in the hands of his family. The national security state in Syria is a little bit stronger, or was a little bit stronger. On the other hand, Assad appears to have be alienating, I should say, some of his domestic allies, and so Assad's grip on power is not assured.
Foreign intervention clearly tipped the scales in Libya to what end? Time will only tell. But is it assumed that NATO will now turn its sights on Syria, and how would that be embraced there?
Well, I don't think NATO will, but you raise a very good point. The strategic rationale that President Obama gave for doing the Libya mission was the responsibility to protect obligation. And that raises serious questions about what he'll do in the future in Libya. What if Libya becomes a bloodbath? What does the responsibility to protect mm-hmm. require us to intervene to protect now the victims of the new regime in Libya? That's one set of questions. But the second set of questions is that Assad has actually the body count is a little bit rough, but may have killed as many people already in Syria as Gaddafi had at the time of the intervention. And so if the responsibility to protect drives you to intervene in Libya, why not in Syria? The answer, of course, that the Obama administration would give is that there was an international cover for intervention in Libya, the UN resolution, the Arab League calling for it. There's nothing like that in Syria, and I don't expect there would be. But at the level of principle, it raises thorny questions. And, of course, at the level of national security interest, we have more at stake in Syria. And so I think pressure for a more forceful U.S. role in the Syrian case, not necessarily a military role, but perhaps leading to create more diplomatic pressure on Assad, something like that, I suspect that pressure will build over the coming months.
Jerry in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes. In the news reports about Libya, I started changing the subject from
okay.
Syria, but you never hear the term army associated with rebels. It's always a band of rebels. I was wondering how cohesive this army actually is, and really, seriously, how they can identify themselves with each other without actually personally knowing the other members of the armed bands they're in.
How do they know who their friend is?
Right. Yeah.
Well, I imagine that that tactically that poses a severe challenge, and that there's probably a lot of quote-unquote friendly fire incidents on the ground. It's not an army in the sense of an organized military unit. It's made up of citizen militias, out-of-work people who grab a gun, or there's a tribal base to it. There is some defectors, people who were part of the regular military in Libya and then defected over. And so it's a real hodgepodge. Now, the one positive development of the long delay, the Libya mission has taken about twice as long or longer than NATO and the Obama administration thought. But one of the benefits, and I should say this, that greater length of time has mostly produced bad things. But the one good thing it has produced is it's given more time for outside advisors to be helping train. And there's some units that are getting pretty good training from special forces and so might be more capable.
Thank you, Jerry, for that call. And thank you, Peter Fever, for joining us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
It's Professor Peter Fever. He teaches political science and public policy at Duke University. He's also director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Coming up, we'll return to our conversation with Hamdi Salomon in a minute. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the great A&P and the struggle for small business in America. In these days of big box supermarkets, we're nostalgic for the corner store, but author Mark Levinson says mom and pop stores with their limited selection and high prices set the scene for national chains like A&P to move in. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Sunshine today, a high of 83, partly cloudy tonight, a low of 61. Some sunshine for Wednesday, also a chance of a shower or thunderstorm in the afternoon, and a high of 85.
Support for 89.7 comes from Antioch University Midwest, helping adults to complete their bachelor's or to start their master's degree. Last call for fall classes begins soon. More information at midwest.antioch.edu.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're focusing today on the international issue of Libya. Joining us now is Hamdi Salomon. He moved here as a teenager. He's now a local businessman. He's an opponent of the Gaddafi regime, and he is here to talk about other ways to achieve a free and democratic, and how achieving a free and democratic Libya might be possible. Welcome back to the show, Hamdi.
Thank you, Ann. Good to be back.
So, you're looking forward to going back. We played the quote that you gave Tom Borgerding yesterday.
Sure.
Upon the news that the rebels were had reached Tripoli, the professor Peter Fever said it might not be that easy to go back at this point and see that kind of an atmosphere in Libya.
Well, for the most part, you know, like for the most part of Libya, the eastern part of Libya, you know, as we know, it's been liberated for a long time. You're going to have small hicks there and there, but for the most part, that's been liberated. And then the west part of Libya, like Misrata, you know, now it's completely under the freedom fighters' hands, Ghrian, Zlitin. And then Tripoli, you know, a city of 2 million people, even Gaddafi's, nobody thought it was going to fall down as quick as it did, you know. We have some setbacks, you know, like with Gaddafi's sons have, you know, at first they were captured and now they're, you know, one of them escaped and one of them, maybe the report saying it wasn't true. But, you know, you look where we started from, you know, 6 months ago in February, and this is a revolution that was led truly by the people. We're thankful to the help that we got from NATO and from the U.S. But, you know, at first it was a little bit of a late start. And then for the most part, the Libyan fighters, they did not have any means. They didn't have any weapons. They didn't have any advice. They didn't have any training. So for the most part, we've done pretty good. You know, like over 80% of Libya has been liberated. 6 months ago, or even 3 weeks ago, Gaddafi had a bigger grip on Tripoli. Today, he lost most of it. He lost more than 50 or 60% of it. This morning, the Freedom Fighter, they have entered the first gate of Gaddafi's Bab al-Aziziyah, Gaddafi's compound household. You couldn't even think of that 10 years ago or a year ago, you know?
What it is surprising to us from where we sit, all of a sudden it seemed like a lot happens. I know you're much more plugged in because of your roots there and your family and friends there. What are you hearing from people?
People are very excited. You know, Sunday when we got the news that Tripoli uprised, and I mean, people are just, even though it's not the complete victory, but to the people that live in Libya and even abroad, but mostly to the people that live in Libya, I mean, victory was there, you know, even though it wasn't finished, the job is not finished yet. But that moment, like I said, to be in Gaddafi's ground and backyard and hometown and the place that he called his office and his shelter and his domain, to be right in there and then be able to raise the freedom flag and be out in the street and shouting that, you know, just a couple of days ago, they would have snatched you and put you somewhere that you wouldn't even know. So to us, you know, even though it's a slow process, but it's a victory. It's a victory.
He's been in power for decades now, and sometimes that kind of power can cover up a lot of other conflicts in a country like Libya, regional conflicts, religious conflicts. It could be a lot of different things when someone controls things so totally. What are your thoughts about what's going to emerge in the wake of
Of course,
Gaddafi?
Our goal or our hope is Libya is going to be a free country, a democratic country. The transitional council has been in works for the last 6 months. They have formed a government on their own to run the country, and then as you hear in the news, with everything's been going on, with the short of money, with the short of aids and the short of food, there hasn't been really any crimes. There haven't been any looting in the streets, so the people are so thankful, just to have that. They're working together. Libya is going to be a little bit different than Iraq or Afghanistan, where you don't have a lot of sector, like the different religion sectors.
Right.
I mean, people are very close. It's a smaller country. Yeah, we have different ideas, different way of thinking, different party. I'm sure they're going to be more in different parties, different groups.
Professor Fever mentioned the tribes.
Yeah, that's what keeps the glue together in the country. The tribes, people know how far they could go back. If somebody does something wrong, the tribe normally would step in and try to resolve the conflict. So that's what's going to keep the tie. Going to keep the country together. And you got to understand, and people have lived without for 42 years, and then nobody's going to come and take over Libya and not run it the right way, because the people won't let them, just like what you see in Egypt now, except in Libya, over 30,000 people have sacrificed their life, and their blood will just not go to waste.
My guest is Hamdi Salaman. He is returning. He was with us some months ago, back when this was just starting.
Yeah.
And you're right, at the time, we talked about how this could go on for a long time.
Yeah.
Now the rebels in Libya have reached Tripoli. They're working on the compound on Gaddafi's compound. We don't know. No one knows where he is right now. We have an email from a listener. They write, Gaddafi and all of his sons have several doubles, lookalikes. How do we really know that was Saif on TV yesterday, Gaddafi's son? And how do we know if it is Gaddafi when he is on TV? Does your guest worry about that?
On The Voice, yeah, there's a lot of people that, play his voice. So on The Voice, yeah, I'd agree. On the picture, yeah, that was his son. It's pretty hard unless you could construct somebody's face, It's pretty hard to say that wasn't safe. But the voice, yeah, Gaddafi's voice, people, there has few speeches that, you think it's Gaddafi, but it's not.
What about the prospect of a humanitarian crisis once this is over?
You know, this is what we're looking for is, you know, the help and the aids. Like, you know, like I said before, Libya, before the conflict, you know, the resources and the backup of medicine was the worst on the United Nations list. You know, they had less than 3 months. And you could imagine for the last 6 months. So there's a lot of shortage. There's a lot of shortage of the basic medicine needs, surgical stuff. And that's what we've been working on for the last few months is trying to send a lot of medical supplies to Libya, you know, a lot of medical containers. And that's what, you know, I was talking to people in the last couple of days. They're saying people are dying when they bring them to the hospital. They're dying because they don't have the first aid, you know, to aid them.
Is still nothing getting in the country?
Nothing goes directly from here because of the sanctions, you know, that the,
right.
But, you know, things are going through Tunisia, going through Egypt. And as you know, that process takes a lot longer because you have to ship it by a ship. You can't do it by air, and it takes 4 weeks. And so it's that makes a very tough part of it. And then the freezing of the assets, you know, that's a lot more tougher.
They're
too.
Working on unfreezing them now, yeah. So the transitional government can.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, like I said, keep in mind, without all that, you know, we still accomplished, a great list of things, you know, to get rid of Gaddafi.
Are people worried about what happens next?
Not to the sense, you know, not to the sense with the Western thinking, you know.
Nervous Nellies over here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've got to understand that, you know, where they've been and what they've been going through, you know, it's a sign, you know, yeah, you know, you're always worried about stuff. You're always worried, but I think the alternative is going to be much better than what they have.
What about the education level in Libya? With a democracy, you have an educated populace is almost critical.
Yes.
Tell us about that kind of infrastructure, that educational infrastructure, and how well are people prepared to transition from not only Gaddafi's dictatorship, but from the tribal way of doing things.
Actually, you know, with the transition council, they kind of elected secretaries or they made departments, and education is one of them, and they have brought some of the older people, some of the people that used to be in charge when Gaddafi first came to power, seeing where they had the basic, the good foundation. Know how to run a government, and they actually worked on putting a curriculum together, and so it's very, very promising. You know, they're aiming to start school, you know, right after Ramadan, which would be August 30th. You know, school is going to resume in Libya full time, at least for the liberated parts. You know, and people because you got to understand, even before when the teachers were going to teach, you know, their salary is not coming on time. They're not getting paid 3 or 4 months. So now it's a lot more different. You know, people are really working with their heart. You know, they got their heart and soul into rebuilding the country. Every single Libyan, is going to have their heart and soul into rebuilding their country, because you're fondly proud to call and this is your country. You know, you want to contribute to it because, you know, nobody's going to steal. Nobody's going to take, you know, take all the resources of the country and keep it to themselves like Gaddafi and his militia did.
You're wearing a pin.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
My pin is
a little ribbon pin.
It's an American Libyan flag, you know, and you know, as
one side of the ribbon is red, green, and black,
and the other side is the star and
stars and stripes.
You know, and for us, you know, even though we're born in Libya, you know, by myself, but I spend more than half of my time here.
And you're a citizen of the United States.
And I'm a citizen of the U.S. I had a political asylum in the '80s, so this is my country as well. You know, we vote. You know, we was talking to Tom. Yesterday, and
Tom Borgerding,
yeah, mm-hmm. And about the voting, and I said, you know, we cherish that, you know, us new citizen, we cherish that because that's something that was taken away from us. So whenever there's an election, we normally ride their first part because, you know, it's a ride that, you know, it's very tough. You know, you don't know it until it's taken away from you, and the Libyan people, that was taken away from them for a long time.
What about what Professor Fever from Duke University was talking about earlier about folks like you and maybe folks who will even move back, not just visit, but move back? And I'm sure when you do go back, you're going to want to help somehow. But the kind of the element of distrust that might exist there for the people who went away and didn't stick it out like like the others?
So far, really, that hasn't been the case. You know, there's a lot of us that went back. You know, I mean, I'll go back to visit. You know, this is like my home base.
You went back last winter for the first time in many years.
Yeah, so I would go back to visit occasionally, you know, more often than I do now because, you know, you miss, you know, so much time of your life that, you know, but like I said, this would be my home base. But actually, there's a lot of people that have left and went back to Libya, Helbin, you know, that were lived in exile for a long time. And you got to understand, probably about like 95% of the Libyans were in exile. They were against Gaddafi from day one. They were always speaking out against Gaddafi. They were keeping Libya in the news. And that's what the Libyan people inside Libya, they're so thankful for that, you know, they keep that Libya story. So I don't think we're going to have as much division as people think we will. You know?
When we were talking last winter, there was a lot of excitement out there because of Yemen and Egypt and, you know, what was going on. It just seemed that there was a sense of something, you know, the spring, the Arab Spring. I mean, that phrase that probably has been misused, but be it as it may, it made people riveted on the topic more than it has been. And we were talking earlier about how, wow, what happened in Libya in the last 2 weeks, things completely turned around. Have Libyans, expats like yourself, have you felt like people haven't been focusing enough on it, that the news hasn't been focused enough on it, or has it been helpful that it hasn't been?
Well, you know, yeah, the part of us felt pretty bad because, you know, you tried to bring the Libyan story to the media and there's no interest.
It's not as sexy as Egypt for some reason,
not,
right?
It's not a selling story, you know. But, you know, that, you know, in a way that maybe kept people focused, you know, and then brought the case a lot more closer, you know, and it's a revolution that's really made, you know, it was made by the people, you know, and the people who are controlling it and they're making it happen. And as you see in the last couple of days, you know, it's back in the news again because, you know, everybody wants to see Gaddafi gone. I mean, you know, the last night on CNN, there was a lady from the Lockerbie bomber and she was saying that she, for 22 years, she was waiting for this day because her husband was killed, an American husband was killed. So everybody wants to see Gaddafi gone because, you know, one way or the other, Gaddafi has inflicted some harm on most of the people in this world, you know.
Any thoughts about when you're going to go back and what you'll do when you go back?
It's it's kind of a little bit hard to say, but a lot of it, you know, once it's liberated, a lot of us that are outside we're doing a lot of humanitarian effort. We're trying to collect a lot of the medicine and try to send a lot of funds to Libya. So our work here is very important as well. But yeah, that's a goal. Hopefully, pretty soon to go and reunite with the family.
If people want to help, if they want to contribute. Where should they go? Who should they call?
The agency, it's hoperelief.org. Hoperelief.org.
Hoperelief.org. If you want to contribute to the revolution in Libya right now, 6-1, you can go to wosu.org/allsides, and we'll post that website there. I just want to say thanks again to Hamdi Salaman for joining us again.
Oh, thank you so much.
Appreciate it. And keep us posted on what happens next.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to All Sides today. Again, if you want to learn more or if you want to contribute to the relief effort over in Libya, go to wosu.org/allsides. We'll put the site on our website and you'll be able to get it there. Thanks for all the calls and the emails today. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.